Hey everyone, before we get started, I want to tell you about BetterHelp. BetterHelp's a virtual therapy platform that makes professional counseling accessible, affordable, convenient, so that anybody who's struggling with life's challenges, or even if it's a mental health problem or illness, they can help you to work through that. They can help you anytime, anywhere, and it's more affordable than in-person counseling, but it works just as well. So BetterHelp actually has access to licensed, trained, experienced, accredited psychologists. They have marriage and family therapists, clinical social workers, board-licensed professional counselors, all screened, all ready to help you, and you get to choose. You can do it from home at the times that work best for you, and you can do it on your own schedule. They've helped in more than 32 million sessions, 32 million sessions with more than 2,000 therapists. So, you know, I'm pretty sure that they can help you too, and I want to be able to help you to do that. You'll be able to sign up for a 7-day free trial just to try it, see if you like it, see what you think. And if you don't, fine, just don't continue with it, but give it a try. So go to betterhelp.com/mark, betterhelp.com/M-A-R-K. Enter my name for the promo code, M-A-R-K, Mark, and you'll be able to get that 7-day free trial to give it a try. So I hope you do that. I hope you take this opportunity. It's a great chance to get some better help. Hey everyone, I'm Mark. Mark Hennick, that's my name, and welcome to the show. It's a show where we have some conversations, about mental health and all kinds of other challenging issues, but inspiring things too, like resilience and overcoming, and that's exactly what I talked to today with Glenn Close, legendary actor Glenn Close, six-time Oscar nominee Glenn Close, along with her sister Jessie and her nephew Kalen. So we're going to get to that in a couple of minutes. I just want to talk to you for a bit before that, and you know, because this was supposed to be released on World Suicide Prevention Day, which was yesterday, but unfortunately, I was a bit over ambitious, I think, and wasn't able to get it out. However, it still is National Suicide Prevention Week, so I think that still works really well, and you know, that's the whole point of this show, is to have conversations with prominent people who have compelling stories to tell, and especially when it comes to mental health and mental illness and suicide. I think that conversations are really just about the best way possible to help break down the stigma of suicide, which is how you prevent it. And, you know, not everybody's super comfortable talking about these kinds of things. I get that. It's a difficult thing. Nobody likes to talk about death anyway, and especially not something as seemingly dark and scary as suicide. Well, suicide is dark and scary. You know, it's I was speaking at Rutgers University last night in New Jersey. Two big crowds of people, 500 and something college students came out and listened. And it was just such an interesting experience. And I get this every time I speak at any other audience. I spoke on Monday as well to a community just outside of Toronto, a small event out there. And people want to talk about these types of things, even really difficult, heavy stories. And even in otherwise light environments, they want to talk about it, but they don't know how. And it's still really uncomfortable for people. And, you know, I've been doing this for a couple of years now, and I've had to learn different strategies to get around that for sure. I mean, you know, some of my initial feedback after I did the TED Talk in 2013, when I signed with a speaking agency to do, you know, I don't like to do any of the business side of this. I just like to do what I'm passionate about and get out there and get on stage or wherever and tell stories. So I signed with an agency to take care of some of that stuff, and there was concern really early on that, you know, we had to find a better way to market what I do, that just marketing suicide talks, you know, talking about death, talking about killing yourself, nobody's going to want to buy it because it's too heavy. And that's part of the business model, is that, you know, we're trying to sell a product here in order to get the opportunity to get in and raise awareness, so that way we can actually make that happen. We can actually finance that, and it turned out that it's still a hard sell, and that was a couple of years ago now, but it's still a hard sell to get people to actually have these brave conversations. So that's why it's never lost on me how grateful I am and how brave people are when they do encourage these kinds of conversations, even if it's not a big, you know, community thing or a big, great big event with speakers and all that. But even just conversations with your family, with your friends, you know, these are the types of conversations that I really believe can save lives. And people are still so afraid to do that because they're afraid. I was talking about this last night. I talk about this all the time. They're afraid, I think, that if you talk about suicide, it gives people the idea to go out and do it, as though they had never thought of it before. As though when I was, you know, 15 years old and I climbed over the railing of that bridge alone, ready to jump, it's not as though somebody earlier that day had said to me, hey, you should think about killing yourself. And I said, oh, okay, that's a good idea. Why don't I go do that? That's not how it works. I had already been struggling for years. Now, you know, there's certainly triggers, and I think we all need to be sensitive to that. But we also need to remember that triggers wouldn't exist. People wouldn't get triggered if there was nothing there to trigger in the first place. And this is where I think, you know, in some places I get a little bit controversial, that I don't think triggers are the problem. Triggers are not the enemy. Actually, in fact, triggers, and this is the way that I've learned to deal with them in myself, and I have a number of my own triggers, they're learning opportunities. Every time I get triggered by something, that's an indicator for me to go deeper into that issue. That, yeah, that doesn't mean that's easy to do. That doesn't mean that I even want to do it, but it's my body telling me, my mind telling me that I need to do it, that there's something here that needs to be explored. So, you know, I take it as an invitation of sorts. Now, you know, not everybody has always interpreted that the same way. I did an event a while back ago, and you know, I thought that the event went really well, and I've kind of got what I do down to a bit of a science now. I've tested lots of different ways of telling my story and opening people up, and the audience seemed to respond really well. But then the event organizer came back to me later and said that they didn't like it, that they didn't think that it went well. And it was because, I think, that I talk so much about suicide and I talk so much about my personal struggle. Well, you know, folks, that's what I do. That's part of the package for me, that you should know what you're getting. And granted, I'm more than happy to certainly, and I do this all the time, adapt to what people need for me. But the fact that I've thought about and attempted suicide is an essential part of my story. It makes me who I am, and actually, it makes me as strong as I am, having that history and being able to reframe around it. So, you know, I was just thinking about that before I wanted to get started with the interview here, because you know, it being World Suicide Prevention Day yesterday and National Suicide Prevention Week this week, that these are still important things we need to talk about. People are talking more and more about mental health now, but suicide in particular is still one of those most stigmatizing issues. And people are trying to talk about it, I think, but they're, you know, there is a right way and a wrong way to do that. I've been very open about the 13 Reasons Why and shows like that, you know, producers and celebrities and stuff, they come out and they say that they're just raising awareness and all this kind of stuff. But yeah, you have to do it right as well. And I take risks when I certainly take risks when I speak openly about my own experience. But the whole point is to bring it around to the fact that my story is not about the fact that I tried to kill myself. My story is about the fact that I didn't kill myself. And that's the whole point. So let's not get trapped up in the drama and the very real drama that people experience, that I experienced. And I'm going to relay those parts of the stories because that's part of the context. But that's not the point of the story. The point of the story is that I didn't, and that I went on to live, and I figured it out mostly through grit and determination, and, you know, with the help certainly of a couple of professionals here and there, and finally finding the right medication and all that stuff. But, you know, it's not like there was some magic pill or some person who finally gave me the keys to happiness and fulfillment. That's not how it worked. And maybe it is for some people, but it wasn't for me. For me, my recovery journey was much more convoluted, up and down, with lots of setbacks, lots of relapses along the way, and I still relapse. But that's okay. And I think that when you simplify the narrative too much, and that was one of my criticisms of 13 Reasons Why, and they didn't really do it much better in the second season, although, you know, they did try to address some of the really intense criticism that I think they justly received, from myself included. It's still unhelpful to oversimplify people's lives, that, you know, their bully caused their suicide, or that particular event in their life caused their suicide. That's not usually how it works. Yeah, they can be really difficult risk factors for people if they're being bullied, for example. But there's all kinds of other stuff that comes along with that too. The psychological trauma that they're experiencing, the inability that their mind isn't letting them overcome the challenge that they're being faced with. That's something different. You know, lots of people get bullied tragically, and we need to stop that. But not everybody who's bullied dies by suicide. I was bullied most of my life, and then actually as an adult in workplaces too, even as a person who has had high risk, I think, for suicide, because I had so many prior attempts, I still had to find ways just to work through it. And that's what I think we need to do. We need to be able to help more people figure it out, that their recovery is going to look different than other people, that it's not the same for everybody. And I really believe that helping them find their passion, helping them find their meaning and their purpose, and actually I mentioned this in the talk yesterday too, not necessarily finding their purpose, but building their purpose. You know, it's not just out there waiting for you on the side of the road, waiting for you to stumble upon it, your purpose. It's something that you have to put the work in to build. And I think that we need to do a better job of helping people do that. And, you know, I think people still struggle to see, well, how is that related to suicide prevention? I think that's the key to suicide prevention. If we're lining up ambulances at the bottom of the bridge and we think that's what's going to prevent suicides, yeah, that's going to be one small part of the system. We have to have that intensive kind of intervention. But we got to go way further upstream than that in order to really, truly help people. We got to go way up and teach little kids how to actually recognize their emotions and how to work through them, and how to remember if I ever get a tattoo, I don't have any tattoos, but if I ever get one, to help me to remember that this too shall pass. Because that mantra, this too shall pass, I've repeated over and over again in my life, that I've been through this before, I'll get through this again. And I have been through that cycle so many times, and it's made me so much stronger. So, you know, I think that that's the whole point of this show, of course. That's the whole point of my speaking. That's the whole point of my life, is to help people have those conversations, to trigger them, to think. And if it does stir up some things that are underlying, you know, underlying their thinking at that time, that's a good thing. That's what I want, because I hope that it triggers people to speak out and either ask for help or demand help or find a way to get through. Because that's all we're all trying to do here. We're just all trying to get through this together. And when we speak openly like that, when we share in each other's journeys, I think that's what saves lives. So, you know, I think that today, when we have this conversation with Glenn Close and with Jesse and with Kaylin, we talk a little bit about suicide. We talk about how Jesse attempted twice, I think she says, and even how Glenn herself didn't realize that she had depression. That she thought that it was just something else going on until her doctor finally suggested it to her. And certainly Kaylin, with his experiences of hospitalization and really being able to see the system from that side, I just thought that they were perfect guests for this kind of conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Before we get over to that, I do want to tell you just a little bit more about BetterHelp. BetterHelp is an online counseling service that you can log into anytime, anywhere. They've got more than 2,000 counselors, licensed, professional, accessible counselors all over America and Canada. You can talk to them about your struggles with a mental illness, with a mental health problem, or you can do what I do. You just go in for a tune-up. You can go in and just try to maximize your life, maximize the way that you're handling with stressors and challenges in your life to really get a step above and to get a step ahead. So, you know, if you go over to betterhelp.com/Mark, I'm going to give you a 7-day free trial. I'm not a big fan myself of just of paying for things and not knowing what they do. I do this with apps all the time. If they have a trial, I'll try it out and see if I like it. Most of the time, I don't keep them, but this was one that I did, that I really love this service, that it helps to open up the world of counseling to a whole new audience. So head over to betterhelp.com/Mark, sign up for the 7-day free trial. If you like it, stick with it, and I think you can really learn some skills that'll help you out. betterhelp.com/Mark. All right, so that's that. Now, I want to hand this back over to my interview that I did with legendary actress Glenn Close. You knew her from Fatal Attraction. Certainly, that was probably her most iconic role. I loved her in Damages. I watched every scene that she did in Damages, along with her sister, Jessie, and Jessie's son, Kalen. They've really come out over the last 10 years or so, a little over 10 years, with an organization called Bring Change to Mind, BC2M, to really raise awareness, and they've been extraordinarily successful at doing that, raising awareness for mental health. So from Glenn Close's apartment in New York City, here's my conversation with Glenn Close, Jessie Close, and Kalen Pick. And they said, well, you know, Jessie and Kalen are going to come too. And I thought, it's almost like somebody had said to me, we'll give you $1 million, but only if we can give you $3 million. And I was like, yeah, okay.
Aww, I guess.
That's no, well, this is amazing.
No, I mean, it's so true. I really don't like talking without one of them, because they're the reason and they're living with. And I just find it, well, you know, just much more effective and powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. And you guys are all, I think, now superstars in the mental health community, especially Jessie and Kalen, for talking so openly about your lived experience. And you do it so effectively, too.
It was 10 years ago.
10 years. Yeah. Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
I just met
2009
with Dr. Is her name Snyderman? Nancy Snyderman?
Yeah.
Who was one of the first national interviews we did 10 years ago when we decided as a family to start talking about it. And she interviewed us for MSNBC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She's never forgotten it, because no one had been talking the way you talked.
Even just 10 years ago, the change that we've seen in such a relatively brief period of time, you know. And I mentioned, so we had met in just briefly in Ottawa when you guys came to do the presentation at the Stigma Conference. Jessie, I remember yours in particular. You brought your little dog up on stage with you. It was so sweet.
She's too old to travel now.
Is she? Oh.
She's 13. Yeah. Can't hold her bladder.
Oh. Well, there you go. There's your inheritance.
Yeah.
So when you came to Ottawa, you all spoke so eloquently about Bring Change to Mind, of course, which now 10 years in. Can you tell us a little bit about what that organization actually is? Maybe, Jessie, if you can tell us how it started and what it is now.
It started with Glenn and a handful of people who, our first big blast onto the scene was Ron Howard came in, thanks to Glenn, and he did an ad at Grand Central Station with us, and we all had our diagnosis on our T-shirts.
I remember it, yeah.
So I had bipolar, Kalen had schizophrenia, and he was smoking at the time. Mm-hmm. He said he'd have to go outside onto the sidewalk and have a cigarette with schizophrenia.
No one bummed a smoke from me or anything, so.
That's all right. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was terrifying, to say the least. We're pretty much old hats at it now. But Bring Change to Mind is an organization, our home office is in San Francisco. And we reach out mostly right now to college and high school children. And it's been extremely effective.
And what are you telling them? What are you reaching out to them with?
Well, you can get a packet from Bring Change Your Mind that will tell you exactly how to start your own college group.
Or the high school.
And in the high school.
And we're working on what we're calling the college toolbox. It's been a pilot program at Indiana University. And because we wanted to have things that had proven effective on that campus. And so it basically is peer-to-peer and campaigns that they come up with and then test. And so it's very exciting.
What's the peer-to-peer piece? Do you know what's it doing? What's the objective?
Well, the basic objective, and it from the beginning and still is, start the conversation. Yeah. Because the thing that keeps people from seeking help, from getting under their cloud of shame or fear about what they're dealing with, is people's inability, because of stigma, not to talk about it. Yeah. So the simple fact that you can go to somebody and say, I need help, which is what Jesse did to me, is huge. So we want to create on campuses stigma-free zones where people feel that it's okay to say that they need help, and then that they will know where to get that help.
I also like to use the word prejudice. But I just noticed online yesterday that Mary Gibelty
From NAMI
yeah. is using the word stigma and has started some new program about stigma. So, I mean, there are organizations that have popped up in the past recently.
Yeah, so you're ahead of your time, I think, leading the pack.
We also have a very active social network community. Where Jesse, you've blogged for it, and a lot of people blog. But it's where one thing that I think can be very, very positive about the social network is that somebody might be able to say, I need help, or this is what I live with, like that, without somebody looking them in the eye. Mm-hmm. So that can be a very, very good first step. And then if it's with a community that says, you're not alone. You know, we understand, because you're not alone is very, very important.
Yeah.
Right. So, very important. Glenn, you mentioned, I think you've mentioned twice now, that Jesse reached out to Glenn for help. And I heard you talk about this before, that, you know, that it was it that it was so difficult finding help for yourself, for Kaylin, dealing with the stigma? You know, why did you reach out to Glenn?
Because she was safe. I knew she would do exactly what she did, was put her arms around me and let me cry. And I was visiting down in Wyoming. Our parents used to live there. And I knew I had to tell someone what was going on in my head. And my daughter was with me, and the car was packed, ready to go. And it was like, okay, it's now or never. I need to go tell her now.
Yeah. How long do you think you'd been struggling up until that point?
50 years.
50 years. Yeah, your whole life.
But that moment, you were specifically struggling with a voice in your head saying, kill yourself.
Really? Yeah, I've had two suicide attempts and one almost suicide attempt with a gun, but I realized my children were there. Kaylin was home from McLean Hospital for the holidays, and I couldn't do that to them. Uh-huh. I just couldn't do that.
So Kaylin, how long had you been struggling by that point?
Probably like a couple years, right? Yeah. Like I was diagnosed at 19 in the hospital. I was hospitalized at 18, diagnosed at 19, I should say.
And, you know, did you have some kind of sense that your mother was not doing well, that she was struggling?
Not really, actually. At the time, I didn't. And I'd been at prep school, boarding school, and my consciousness was still kind of developing, I guess. And, you know, as a son, I didn't really, I guess I didn't see that in my mom, to the, you know, I know it's hard to see within someone like that, but, still, I didn't recognize it for what it was. But
I mean, you had a bit of your own stuff going on.
Yeah. So. I was kind of self-absorbed.
Yeah, yeah, you did.
You were in recovery.
Yeah.
So, Jesse, then, I mean, parenting a kid, I've come to learn, is hard on its own, with or without a mental illness, although I don't really know without. That must have been hard for you to try to help your son and deal with your own stuff, too.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, I can definitely validate that.
Kaylin's sister, who's 10 years younger than him, saw up close a lot of what I was going through. I actually just came out of a depression, and I hadn't been depressed for so long. I got hold of my daughter, and I said, "But I'm dizzy." And she said, "Yeah, Mom, that you were dizzy when you're so depressed, and I can't stop eating, and I'm paralyzed." And she was able to remember all those same symptoms and kind of help me realize what was going on. I thought I was getting sick or something, but
So you have bipolar disorder, right?
Yes.
Yeah. How does, as you mentioned, a bit of the depression side, but everybody manifests these things differently. You know, there's if you show me 10 different people with bipolar disorder, they have 10 different types of bipolar disorder sometimes, it seems, and likewise for depression. So how did yours really manifest itself, both the depression and the mania side?
I actually was more manic than I was depressed. The reason I stay on meds as strictly as I do is because of depression, though, because depression is so debilitating, and it pushes me immediately to think about killing myself, and it's a dangerous place to be. And again, I didn't recognize it, and it was really interesting that my daughter did. And I'm okay now, but
this was just recently. Yeah. It was the change. Do you think it was change of season, or
could have been? I mean, I usually get manic in the spring, or hypomanic, and I was like, "Damn, I hope this doesn't happen every spring, because I'd rather be hypomanic than depressed."
Sure. You know, this is really interesting. I hear about this a lot from mental health advocates, and this is kind of seems to be a class of people unto themselves now. Everybody is a mental health advocate in some ways, and I think that's a good thing. But there's expectations of people in the mental health advocacy world that you're doing great and that everything is always awesome now and you've come out the other side. So you're saying that you still struggle from time to time.
Of course. Yeah.
How often?
I don't take anything for granted as a sibling.
Yeah.
I mean,
what?
I don't take anything for granted, because a lot of people, a big percentage of people with bipolar disorder, end up taking their own lives.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I don't take that for granted.
So, Glenn, you've also mentioned your own struggles with depression, too. So it's not like this doesn't affect you directly as
well. Yeah, it's interesting, though. I didn't have the serious, totally debilitating crawl in a hole and not be able to move depression like Jesse did, or like one of my very dearest friends has had. But I had kind of a steady feeling of inertia, and couldn't organize myself, and I would contemplate doing the simplest things, and it would be overwhelming. And for example, that the cap of my toothpaste would fall off, and I'd say, "Okay, now bend down, pick it up, screw it back on." It's like, you know, it's like the silliest things. You say, "Oh, just leave it." No. Yeah. So I thought, wow, I thought I had actually ADD because I couldn't get myself together. And I went for a series of tests, and at the end they said, "You're depressed." And I said, "What?" Because I don't think I come off as a depressed person. I don't know. But
or that old stigma, what do you have to be depressed about, right? Yeah, I think people still say that in some ways.
Yeah, but I also think we have so much in our family, I wasn't surprised.
Right.
So I take a a low amount of antidepressant, and I think it does make a difference. I also try to, I have learned to if I get really stressed, that it's okay to have a timeout. You know, literally go read a book for two hours, or go and do deep breathing, or go for a walk, or, you know, something that really can just, you know, kind of even things out. I also, a friend of ours, Jason DeShaw out in Montana, he said that, and I listened, and I've told everybody I talked to, is that we're so easy, we're so used to emptying ourselves out. If we're somebody who feels like we owe, you know, and we want to give back and all, you empty yourself out, and then you struggle to fill yourself back up, and then you empty yourself out. Well, Jason says, no, that's, you know, the way we should think about it is you deal with the world with the overflow. And that means you've got to take care of yourself and keep your own cup full. And it's okay to do that.
Yeah.
And you'll be more effective if you deal with the world with the overflow. Yeah. I love that idea.
I do too.
Do you find that people reach out to you now more since starting Bring Change to Mind to help?
Personally, no. 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 But I don't think that's, I think that's because I'm not really in a position to be someone that people would seek out. Right. Jason for one, and people at the hospital that I met. I mean, this is an easy conversation to begin with people who have experience. So, yeah. I mean,
Glenn mentioned self-care and some of her ideas around that. What do you do now to take care of yourself?
Self-care. I try and eat well. For one, I think that's important. Staying busy is important. And I also have the freedom to, you know, make artwork and stuff like that too. So, and my wife, Megan, we have like, we have 4 horses and 2 dogs and 3 cats. So it's,
wow,
it's challenging at times, but,
yeah.
You go camping a lot, you guys.
Yeah. I like the outdoors. Yep. Outdoors are important to me.
Can we go back to your art for a second?
Sure.
Because this is a theme that I've heard a lot from people, especially with schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, things that kind of, in my perception, unlock your mind in many ways. Unfortunately, in many ways, uncomfortably so, and tragically so too many times. But I've met so many people who are extraordinary artists.
Yeah.
Do you think that you channel some of your experience into that?
Yeah, I think channel is a good word for making artwork. And I think... it becomes like a conversation in itself, you know, the canvas and working on the canvas, especially with painting. But it becomes like this interface. It's like sort of a metaphor to life. And so as I'm realizing things about, you know, how the painting is working or not working, a lot of times that's kind of reciprocated by, you know, stuff in my life that I can kind of, yeah. So it does open up a certain channel.
Yeah. And when did you start doing that? Or when did you just discover?
I've always been interested in artwork and always been driven to do it. But I think it was only about like, well, not only, but 14, 15 years ago, I started doing it to the point of, you know, trying to make, you know, make a sort of a living at it.
Give them your website.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So KalenPick.com has some examples. Yeah, it's a really... important process for me.
Yeah,
in terms of understanding myself.
Back to the prior to that, about 15 years ago. So actually, how long would you say you've been in recovery?
Probably for 5 years, 5-6 years, something like that. I've been feeling pretty even keel.
What does that mean?
Even keel to me, just I think it's coming back to the still, you know, the center point, and just the pure ability to be able to do that, to be able to kind of drop the built up sort of thoughts, and come back to the point where, you know, you can kind of start over.
What were the symptoms that bothered you the most?
Symptoms that bothered me the most were probably anxiety. That was a hard one to get sort of a handle on. and it continues to be. I don't know. I think depression was a big one for me. Also, the mania for me was troubling. And it became troubling, even though it was a good feeling. It was just, I was going too fast.
So did you experience hallucinations and delusions?
Never had any visual hallucinations. I had some auditory hallucinations and even olfactory hallucinations, but no visual stuff.
Oh, but even still, I mean, these take lots of different forms. So, I think I had heard at one point in another interview that your mother had dropped you off at hospital,
right.
And of course, you didn't want to stay.
Right.
And she had to explain to you why coming home wasn't an option.
Yeah, I remember that. And it was mostly, I mean, that brings up like the fact that I was so scared. Yeah. You know, I mean, I was just like, so hell bent on fear. It was created by so many different kind of ideas and like experiences that it just felt so real. And to be you know, kind of alone, I think, in a strange place, although it was very comfortable and the people were awesome. I mean, it was upsetting, you know, to be dealing with that. Because I think it's something that I kind of held myself responsible for getting things right, and this was a major indication that things were not right.
Were you angry with your mother at the time, or
sad? I had some anger towards my mom, yeah, and I expressed that by, she was the one that I'd call and kind of be like, "Oh, you're never going to see me again. I'm going to go into the woods," and you know, and it was, you know, threatening, that kind of thing. There were real feelings, but yeah, so I kind of put that on her. You know, I'm sorry for that.
It's okay. It wasn't you.
Are you grateful that she did it now?
Yeah, I'm grateful that Guy too, you know, and all my family members have been incredibly supportive. Yeah, and yeah, my grandmother more than anyone else was really supportive of my artwork too.
Well, wouldn't you say that you say you had no visual hallucinations, but you would see things that would morph?
No, like the only visual hallucination I ever had was, and again, I know I'm going back on saying that I didn't ever have any, but it was, didn't register as like a lengthy or even that real, but I was walking in Harvard Square in Boston and very scared, delusional, and I kind of caught the glimpse out of the corner of my eye, this lady kind of going at me like that, you know, and I was kind of thinking, you know, vampires were real and stuff like that, you know, and that was a little freaky.
to say the least,
but it really helps you, I think, to understand how when people are in that place, why they would react in unusual ways, maybe.
Right.
If I thought vampires were chasing me, I'd probably react. And
yeah, so it's that sort of where reality meets the sort of interior.
Yeah, that was one of the scariest nights for your dad and me, because I thought you called me and I thought you were at the hospital.
Right. They kept pretty good tabs on me, but I got it.
Yeah. So I called the hospital to tell them that he was not okay. And they said, "He's not here." And I was just,
Well, again, that's the kind of stress that was undue and I mean, happened, but you know,
So
that was the dynamic that was happening, I think, between
I think there are a lot of parents out there, though, who would understand that that's just what you go through when one of your children
had gone with a bus load of people into
No, I went with a couple of friends, actually.
From the hospital,
but I veered off, and that's something I would do is I would get to the point where I think it was, I don't know how the words for it really, but like I was so sure that what I was thinking, it was again that kind of validation of what was going on. So I was hanging on to these ideas and got really angry, I think, and left my buddies and went walking. I ended up getting lost. And
terrifying.
But yeah.
Well, can you remember what you were hanging on to that you thought was going on?
Yeah. I mean, it was all sorts of stuff. Not any one thing, but it was a mixture of things that did it. anxiety, built it up quickly, fear. I've had all sorts of different kind of delusional type stuff. And so it's been that kind of reality checking that I really value.
Knowing what you know now, if you had run into yourself in at that time in that park or in the woods, what would you tell that person?
You know, I don't know, but I'd say probably that, you know, you're going to get it back. You know, you don't have to beat yourself up as much as you are. And, you know, I mean, I think if you keep struggling, it's, you know, you can attain the things that you want for yourself as yourself, you know, like you, the things that make you who you are. You know, you, someone shouldn't have to get so discouraged that they, you know, it's that hope that, you know, okay, maybe someday I'll be who I want to be, you know, is, you know, that's a real thing. I think it can manifest, you know, that's what recovery is for me, I guess.
Yeah. What could your mother have done to best support you at that time?
She did what she could do, you know, not to say every choice she made was right, but she showed me love, you know, just like didn't get embarrassed by, you know, me or her, you know, around her friends and stuff like that. And that sort of attitude towards it, I think was, and we share a, you know, a camaraderie, you know, with it.
Jesse, did you ever blame yourself for what he went through?
Yeah, probably. But I also immediately started reading, and Kalen's dad was also very...
Yeah, he was really involved, like he, with NAMI, he got really quickly involved with NAMI and actually became certified to teach a class. And this was locally in Helena, Montana.
Yeah, and Kalen was living with him when he ended up at the first hospital.
Yeah, when I was first hospitalized.
Yeah.
So now I think 18, but yeah. Lots of families go through this kind of thing, as you've found out over the last 10 years of doing Bring Change to Mind, but not every family goes and starts an organization to try to combat the stigma or, you know, to, you know, so what triggered that? Why was your family different that wanted to take that step?
We had Glenn.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. But even celebrity families, there's lots of celebrity families that go through this kind of thing.
Yeah.
There've been several times in my life/career where I've been presented with a possibility, and this possibility was do something, even though I didn't know what it was I would do. I know that you talked about stigma, because when Kalen came out of the hospital, all his friends left him.
Yeah, and good reason probably, but I shouldn't say that.
Well, no. They didn't come back.
No, they did not.
They did not.
No,
come
they
back.
Did not.
And you went through issues about stigma as well. So I always ask myself, I could do this. This is what I'm being asked to do. Or not. What is the alternative? I mean, what is the alternative to not doing it? And I always find that I'm not happy with that alternative.
Did you ever have a pause where you thought, would this harm my career? How people look at me? How, you know?
Yes, and I actually kind of still think that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're a family who's come out very strongly to talk about the mental illness in our family, and you never know what people think. But you know what? I don't care.
I was just going to ask, does it matter?
It doesn't matter to me at all.
Yeah.
In fact, I like talking about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many people who don't. I feel motivated to talk about it. And I like to hear other people's stories. And mm-hmm. I like to hear other people talk about the diagnosis, because it's a chronic illness.
Mm-hmm.
And a chronic illness is a chronic illness, and we should be able to talk about it. And it's a huge part of being a human being.
Now, on that, you've called Jesse one of your true heroes. What do you mean by that?
Because my definition of a hero is someone who goes against the crowd. A hero isn't somebody who's just doing their job. A hero is something goes out on their own and does something that not everybody else is doing, something that takes courage. Now, when I put myself in their shoes with the idea, because I said I wasn't going to do anything unless they did it with me, because that, you know, the point was that we would do it together, because celebrity can lose credibility so fast. And I wanted us to be totally authentic all the time. And, when I put myself in their shoes, sitting in an interview for a national television show
and talking about living with bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, I have always been overwhelmed by the amount of courage that that took. And that courage is why we're here today, really. It started this for us, for our story of mental illness and for what contribution we've been able to make through Big Change to Mind. It wouldn't exist without the moment. And they, I don't know how long it took you to say yes. I think it was a phone call. And everyone else at the library at Fountain House, yeah. And you said yes.
What's changed in that time, do you think, in the mental health world? Or just in the world, I guess, with how people think about mental health?
People are talking about it.
Yeah.
There's still, like, we're from Montana, and I just talked to a guy who is busily trying to raise money for mental health in Bozeman, precisely. And he said it's really interesting because he'll be talking to people, usually couples, who have a lot of money. And they are very willing to put money into other things. But when he brings up mental illness, it's like, zip their wallet shut. Mm. And I don't get that.
Stigma.
Prejudice.
It's prejudice.
Sort of an inherited stigma, too, because it, you know.
Fear.
It's like, yeah.
Well, that means they probably, well, I think 1 in 4 people. Yeah. As Jesse says, we have 2 siblings. There are 4 of us in my generation in our family. Jesse was 1 in 4.
Yeah.
And when we all have various, we're all on the spectrum in some way.
Yeah.
You know, but she's the one who got hit hard. So.
And then I gave it to
you. Can't. There's no family that hasn't been touched by it. Mm-hmm. Even if it's their neighbor. And I'm getting angry. I'm feeling my anger build up because our government should be funding mental health. They should be funding community mental health centers so people know where to get help. And it should be on a high level, and it shouldn't be, as somebody said to me, if you have a heart attack, somebody doesn't go write a grant so that you can get treated.
Right.
You know, if that's the same, if somebody has a serious psychotic break and you don't have a place that it is funded that you can go get help, that's, to me,
yep.
It's criminal. I'm also getting tired of all these different organizations. I think I'm talking now way ahead of where I am, but I really want to see us have a unified voice about this in the country and in Washington. And I think every organization in England, they are so far ahead of us. And Canada and Australia, but they have these kids that they call champions who talk about it, come out about it, and then they learn how to advocate, and they go into their local governments and into the, you know, into the newspapers and everything. They actually are active in, you know, getting the word out. And I think of all the kids that we're working with in high schools and in Indiana University. They should be going into their governor's office, and
mm-hmm.
we should all be down there in Washington. So, I don't know. It's been brewing. It's brewing in the back of my head that it's really about time.
It's infuriating.
It's such a terrible. There's such a terrible need.
But I mean, if for the last 10 years, the influence that you've all had has certainly moved the needle. We see that every day.
Yeah.
An organization like Bring Change to Mind couldn't have existed 30 years ago, even 15 years ago, prior to you guys starting it. You know, actually, I know we need to wrap up, but if Jesse had come to you, Glenn, 30 years ago, what would you have said?
I wish I had known because. Well, I have a vignette that I wrote in her book that when she was little, she must have been about 6.
5.
She would rub her hand between her pointing finger and her thumb until it was crusty and bleeding. Now, that's not a normal thing. If I saw that 30 years ago, I would get help. If I had gotten help or knew about it or had been educated about some of the signs of some sort of mental health issue, she wouldn't have been diagnosed when she was 50 years old. She wouldn't have tried to kill herself multiple times. She would have, you know, and so I think the great news is that there are a lot of early intervention things happening. There's a lot mm-hmm. of research. There's a lot. And the whole genetic revolution, you know, all that. But mental illness is not just one gene. It's so the research that needed is huge. But
so knowing what you know now, you've revisited a character 25 years later.
Twice.
So if you could revisit Alex Forrest from Fatal Attraction, would you play her differently?
I don't think I would have played her differently. I would have fought to have certain things put in the script that might have explained her behavior a little bit differently. And that's a tricky fight. I had secrets. There were things that you knew that she, you know, if she had a problem with her father or something happened with her father, but it was all kind of nebulous. And she became one of the great villains of the 20th century film, you know.
But even you've described her as a tragic character, not an evil one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But people think of her as evil.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I would have. So, but I think it's funny because Dr. Gunderson, who's kind of the guru of borderline personality, says that uses that as an example of extreme. Extreme is an important word. Extreme borderline personality. So I actually was playing a bona fide diagnosis, but I was coming at it from a different area.
Sure, and a different time too, I think. So mm-hmm. in 30 years from now, and I'll open this up to all of you, how would you like to see mental health portrayed and talked about and accepted? And
30 years, I don't think I'll be here. 20 maybe.
Okay, 20 years in the future.
You better be here in 20 years.
Yeah. What's the long-term vision here? How would you like to see this change?
I get lots of calls, mostly from mothers who are very worried about their children. I would like them to not have to call me. I would like them to have a place where they can go and consult and have their child evaluated for free. I mean, when you think about how many people are walking around with a mental illness and suffering, and there's nowhere for them to go unless they have hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Or they get arrested and end up...
Or they get arrested, yeah. And our prisons are, what, one-third at least mm-hmm. of the people in our prisons?
Largest mental health treatment centers in the world.
Yeah.
Prisons.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. I'd like to see... people understand that recovery is possible. It really is. And it's just a matter of, you know, finding people treatment again.
Yeah. And whatever kind of intervention works for them. Yeah. Well, thank you all so much for
this. Thank you.
It's great to learn more about this organization. And where can people go if they want to check out more about Bring Change to Mind?
To bringchangetomind.org or just BC2M. .org.
All right. And you're on Twitter and Facebook. You mentioned a very active social media. So I hope that people check that out. And I'd like to thank you all for changing the world. This is, you're doing such incredible work. Thank you.
Well, that's it. That's the conversation with the amazing Glenn Close, her sister Jessie, her nephew Kalen. You know, it was just such a privilege for me to be able to get to visit with the three of them and to have that kind of conversation. You know, something that Glenn really said that stuck with me was that her definition of a hero is that somebody who goes against the crowd. I you know, it's not easy to do that, to really stand up and to say things and do things that you know is right, but that maybe makes you uncomfortable, but there they are doing it, and they've been doing it for 10 years with Bring Change to Mind. Hey, something else you might want to do that is against the crowd is trying online therapy. So head over to betterhelp.com. /mark. That's betterhelp.com/MARK. Try out the 7-day free trial, betterhelp.com/mark. I want to thank Glenn Close as well as Jesse Close, Jesse's son Kaylin Peck. It was just such a privilege. After doing the Rosie O'Donnell episode and now this one, it's just so incredible to be able to hear these amazing people share their stories so openly. We're going to be back with the second one this month, the author, Mandy Stattmiller, and then we've got a few more lined up coming up in October, of course, World Mental Health Day on October 10th. So that's it for me. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll talk to you next time.